Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the last talk of the Range Retreat. And as you know, that for the next month there will be no Wednesday night talks. Give me a break. Seems to be wherever I go I have to open my mouth and give talks. And really, that I remember once going to see Ajahn Tate. He's one of the monks which I really loved the most. The one who really looked like an arahat. And I never get the vision out of my mind that when I went to see him in his monastery, just in Nong, it was Nong Khai province, but to the west of Nong Khai, quite a long way, on the banks of the Mekong River. And the king had built this big hall for him. They called it a mandapa, a mondop in Thai. And it was very, very extravagant for a forest monastery. And I was a bit apprehensive of going to see him, but I always remember going into this room, which was probably maybe two-thirds the size of this hall, very beautifully designed, with a lovely view over the Mekong River. And there in the corner, sitting on a chair, was this monk. And just the way he looked and the aura around him was that he was like a very good monk, a holy monk. Very peaceful, he just put in this position just by the King of Thailand. You could see that there was a monk who more belonged under a root of a tree, at the root of a tree with just leaves and branches over him. But he was put in that position just because that was his cause and effect, fate if you like. But I always remember just asking him, going into his sort of presence if you like, and think of all these questions you like to ask this great monk. You know, because that's what we do like to know. We want to know the answers to things. We want to get the solutions to our problems. But then when I came up to him, just all those questions had disappeared. And what I said was, and it's really a stupid thing to say, but it was actually, in a sense, it made my journey there look stupid, but it was a very wise thing to say, was that actually it's much better we don't ask questions, we find the answers out for ourselves. And that sort of made him smile and say, yeah, that's the way to go, to instead of relying on other people, to find out the truth for oneself, to actually take responsibility, you know, for one's wisdom, for one's peace, for one's virtue. Because sometimes we have an information overload these days. Not only have we have these huge amounts of talks all compressed into MP3s on people's iPods, there's so much Dharma available. We've got all the suttas, even the suttas in Chinese, suttas in Thai, as well as the suttas in English, and some suttas in German as well. And you can even look at it on the computer in the office and have it all there in a disc. So much information, and so many talks which come around. And sometimes you wonder just how much do you really need? And you all know that in the time of the Buddha, there was just one sutta, like the sutta we just chanted, the fire sermon, just one teaching was enough for people to actually to see the truth, to see the way for freedom, for peace, for happiness, for balance in their life. And it's really true that sometimes that, you know, especially Westerners, we just devour information. And just like that, you know, people are overweight and obese because they eat too much food. Sometimes our brains are overweight and obese because we eat too much information. And that information, unless we know how to deal with it, can just confuse us. And the nature of the teachings of the Buddha, it's just so clear, so simple. Not to do anything which is bad, not to do only things which are good, to purify the mind. And so, all these things, you may say three things, but it all boils down to one thing, this beautiful path of peace, of harmony. Of harmony between oneself and harmony between others. Peace to others and peace towards oneself. Kindness towards others and kindness towards oneself. And this was basically the path which the Buddha taught. And sometimes you can keep it very simple, and the simple teachings are sometimes at the very, very best. All one needs to do is to make peace with things, and just to do one's duties. As monks, you know, we are committed to following the Vinaya. And so instead of thinking about these rules, you know, it's just what we do. And it makes sense, because if you follow the rules, it leads to peace, leads to freedom, leads to harmony. And if you sort of start bending them, it leads to the opposite. Which is why you have that great teaching which the Buddha gave to Upali. He gave the same teaching to Mahapajapati, the first bhikkhuni, and to a couple of others, I think. Which was that you'll know what Buddhism is, what the Dharma is, what the right path is, because it leads to this beautiful sense of freedom, of peace. It leads to the moving away from the things of the world, the nibbida, the viraga, the fading away of the problems, especially of life. Viraga, nirodha, the cessation. Nibbida, viraga, nirodha. The peace. Upasamaya, sambodaya, nibbanaya, sangvatati. So it leads to the upasama, just a beautiful peace. The word upasama, also, whenever you see that, the sama on the end, it means like the evenness of the mind. So the peaceful in all situations. It's almost like equanimity, but it's a much stronger form of equanimity, in the sense that, it doesn't matter what happens, one has this gentle, constant, peaceful way of dealing with the things in the world. It's basically where one takes out the mental arrow of suffering. The physical arrows of suffering, yeah, things happen in the world, but the mind just looks at it all and said, yeah, here we go again. This is just the nature of samsara. You know, the samsara is suffering. As the great arahats would often say, that what really life is to see suffering arising and suffering passing away, suffering arising and suffering and passing away. And as if you just stand there in the middle, just allowing it to happen, not reacting, and just going around as if no one could recognize you. The other great arahats, you know, many of them were unrecognizable. People didn't know they were arahats. They just went on their arms around, they ate their food, they did their chores, they did their jobs, they went to bed at night, they woke up in the morning. They disappeared. Not by being different. They disappeared by just fitting into the community and not standing out in any way. And that sort of that evenness, that levelness, you know, is again part of that middle way practice. So, whatever leads to this beautiful state of peace, happiness, stillness, that is actually the path. And sometimes you can teach. You can teach people to practice their virtue, to keep the precepts. But in the end, you can teach that, and you know, I'm not going to check up on what you do in your hearts or what you do in your spare times. It's wrong for me to do that, but it's not just wrong, it's just counterproductive. Because if you come to monastic life, you have to have the commitment that, you know, you really want to make some happiness here. All I can do is just to show you, and you know, what the Buddha does, what the teachers, the Kuba Ajahns do, what the books say, is that, look, if you want to have a happy life, a peaceful life, you got to restrain the defilements, to say no to them, not to screw yourself up, but to realize that sort of indulging in the pleasures of the senses, you know, just whether it's eating too much or sleeping too much, at the end of, you know, the rains retreat, you think, gee, what a waste of time it was. And don't think that you can get away with the lack of indulgence if you return to the lay life, or like the lay people here are going home. It's not a matter of whether you live as a monk or a lay person. It's just whenever you indulge in these things, you just wear out your spiritual power, and you get sucked down into the ways of the world. Sure enough that people appear happy on the outside. But there's that great saying of George Bernard Shaw, who was once asked, why is a Christian feel happier than a non-believer? He said, that's no more to the point than a drunk person appears happier than a sober one. You know, it's just borrowing happiness, because after you get drunk, you have to have a hangover afterwards. And that's just basically the world of the five senses, the lay community, who are just pursuing pleasures by going to movies and going to sort of parties, having sex or whatever. That's almost like being drunk on the five senses. You're borrowing happiness. And afterwards you get into sort of depressions, negativities, anxieties towards the end of one's life. So really that as monks here, that virtuous conduct. So just, you know the rules of the Patimokkha, you know the rules of the core what, you know the duties you have to do. And in public and in private, you just do those things. Because, you know, we chant, whenever we give the five precepts, you know, Silena Sugatin Yanti, Silena Bhoga Sampada, Silena Nibbutin Yanti, Tasama Silang Visodaye. I don't know where that actually comes from, but it makes a lot of sense to me. The first one, Silena Sugatin Yanti, it leads to the happy abodes. And certainly what the Buddha did say, in places like the Samanyapala Sutta, that anyone who keeps those five precepts, or eight precepts, or ten precepts, or the Patimokkha rules, or the rules of a monastery, now this is our sila, this is our virtue. You get this beautiful happiness of virtue. The Avayapajja Sukha. The happiness which comes from being blameless. It's an incredible happiness to see happen when you look back on what you've done today. You look back at what you've done on the last 3 months. You look back at what you've done on the year and you feel so good about yourself. That you have actually restrained. You've kept these precepts. You've done the right thing. You know, you've given up. You haven't just done things in secret which I don't know about, thinking, oh, how clever I am. I can just keep these little pleasures of the senses. And who cares? You know, in the end you do care. It's not a sense of being guilt and punishing yourself. It's just that you lose that beautiful freedom born of restraint. And every one of you should have experience to check, you know, by cause and effect, you know, what you do and the effect it has on your happiness levels, on your peace, on your sense of freedom. You should know that sometimes when you indulge, when you do things which are wrong, but you know, just do it in secret, you know that sort of hurts you, that takes away your peace and happiness and freedom. At least you should be seeing that by now, you're wise enough. Because when one restrains, one feels the sense of peace and also the sense of power. Every time in my monastic life, or even before when I was a layperson, every time I gave up things, I restrained my desires. You always felt a sense of power. Remember when I gave up alcohol, when I gave up meat to become a vegetarian? You got a sense of, like, power. And of course, at that time, I never realized what that power was. What that power was you're not in the thrall of the defilements anymore. You'd actually kicked the butt of the defilements, and so you were freer from them. It was literally like being released from prisons, being released from bondage. As a monk of 33 years now, you can actually see that. This is my experience. The more you indulge in those five senses, just the more you tie yourself up in a prison. And the more you sort of stop that greed, hatred and delusion, you resist it, you say no to it, and you follow the path of the Aryas. And sometimes you say, what would a Buddha do? What would a Mahamoggallana or a Sariputta do? What would my teacher, Ajahn Chah, do? What would these great monks do? They say, well, this is good enough for them, maybe that's what I should do. You can't go far wrong when you follow the examples of the great monks. You know, I'm talking about the monks in the suttas. When you actually start doing things like that, you get a sort of an even and a happy mind. Because that you are overcoming, you are resisting, you are letting go of those things which cause the suffering in life. So when we start to keep the virtue and keep the core, what, your happiness level increases. You have a greater sense of freedom. And with that greater happiness, a greater sense of freedom, your mindfulness increases. you get more peace, meditation gets better, simply because you've got the meditation on the footing of the happiness born of virtue. I make a lot about the happiness practices. It gives you the happiness of contentment as well. You feel that this monastic life is actually giving you something. The retreat was worthwhile because you're happy, you're at peace. Wow. The very least, I've kept all these beautiful rules, I've restrained myself, my mind has become more free from the desires. And please look upon this as freedom from the desires, not freedom of desires. Because sometimes you go out in the world and you get pulled by the nose. Beautiful girl comes along, you just have to look at her. Sooner or later, sort of you're going out, and then you get so caught, and once you get caught soon, you know, you have the handcuffs. You know, there's two rings to a handcuff. One is called the engagement ring, the other one's called a wedding ring. You're cuffed, just like the policemen do. And then you're stuck for years. And then even if you don't get married and have a kid, now they test up your genes and you have to pay maintenance for the rest of your life. So be careful of just, you know, what you do, that you get caught into the world. And once you get caught, it's a common thing with desires. First of all, you think you own the desires, you're in control of them. So you indulge. But then after a while, the desires control you. You're not indulging anymore, you just have to. You've got no choice. You're in the prison of your desires. It's a strange thing, but this is actually what happens when we control any monster. First of all, we think that we can control them, but then they control you. I remember seeing the play Waiting for Godot a long time ago. I forget who the characters were now, but one of them had their dog and was sort of leading the dog around in the first part of the play. In the other part of the play, the dog was the master. And the former master, the man, was actually now having to walk on all fours with a collar and leash on him. It was just one of the themes running through that play, that the master and slave usually turns around, or as much the master is now the slave. And this is what happens with our cravings and desires. We, first of all, we're the master. And we think we have power over these things and control them and bend them to our will and to our purpose. But after a while, it's not that long. The cravings and the desires, the moods of the mind tend to control us instead. So to be able to get freedom, we have this restraint. We say no to desires and cravings and the things which we like through the five senses. We say no to them. And you get this incredible, wonderful, marvelous sense of freedom. You don't have to have these things. I remember some monks here, they have to have their nap in the afternoon. But sometimes you have to go out, you can't get that nap. Sometimes you have to have the nap at night. You have to sleep at night. Sometimes you can't sleep at night, you have overnight flights or whatever. It's great knowing that you don't have to have these things. Yeah, it may be nice if you can get your sleep at night, but if you don't get it, you're not going to die. It's nice knowing you can have a meal, but if you don't get the meal, you're not going to die. So sometimes, even though the our tradition never recommended fasting, sometimes it's good to go on a fast just for one day, just to show you can do it, in case one day you have to. This is important to be able to do that. I remember some time ago when I decided, just to make sure I can still do it, to give up tea for the whole range retreat. I always remember that range retreat, because as soon as I announced that I was going to give up tea for the whole 3 months range retreat, Ajahn Yanadama came to see me in great concern. I said, "What's your concern about? It's only just giving up tea. That's an easy thing to do." And he said, "No, a couple of years ago he was with another monk who remained nameless, another English monk, and he gave up tea for the whole 3 months of the rage retreat. And that was my worst rage retreat ever, dealing with this very angry, grumpy, terrible monk who needed his tea just to be normal." I said, "No, I'm going to have a nice time." So it didn't really affect me that much. So it's nice to be able to sometimes loosen the grip of the things you think you need to have, to show that you can be free and be free. The less you have, the less you need, the freer you are. It means that these things don't own you. You can own them. So be careful of one's sensory desires and pleasures. They can actually turn upon you, and then you're being led by them. So you've seen that happen. You've probably seen it happen towards yourself at times. You see that happen to other people. So please be free. It's very simple teaching. You just need to restrain, just to say no. And just to keep the rules, the Patimokkha rules, and keep the Kawat rules. When you do that, you find incredible sense of freedom and peace. Not only that, when you go to other monasteries in the world, you get this wonderful sense of confidence. This is actually something it says in the sutta. The person who keeps the precepts and keeps the Kawat, that wherever they go in the world, they go without fear. It gives you a sense of fearlessness, that you're not going to get caught out because there's nothing to get caught out on. And you can leave your hut open on Katina Day, and you don't worry because there's nothing there. People go into your hut, they won't steal anything because there's nothing valuable there, and they've got nothing to be embarrassed about. What a wonderful state of mind that is. Could you sort of be happy that people rummage around your room and leave and say there's hardly anything there and get inspired afterwards? That should be sort of our goals, to have the freedom, the peace, the happiness born of just keeping the rules of a monk, living simply, being frugal, and just following the Vinaya. So it's not just something which is just archaic. It's something which does lead to that freedom. And it gives us a framework by which we can live in the world. Because sometimes, what's the point of doing this? What's the point of doing that? Can we do it a different way? It's just our tradition. We're wearing the robes of a Buddha. We volunteer to become monks. So this is just our duties, our obligations, to try and behave in such a way that if the Buddha was here, he would be proud. He would be pleased that you're following in his old traditions. So by doing such things, we develop this very, very strong, virtuous conduct. And we develop the happiness based on this virtue. The virtue doesn't become an imposition on us. If it's an imposition on us, we get sort of stressed and feel tight and feel all these are shoulds and musts. But basically the virtue is, why not do it? You're a monk. And gee, it leads to peace. And so it becomes so second nature to you. Not because you're just brainwashed, because you can see that just what do I want to do all these things which will break a precept? It just cause more trouble for me. If you see very clearly about what these precepts are all about, it's just what the Buddha said. It's just like an infant would not put their hand in the fire. Maybe they put it in there once because they're not quite sure what fire is. But when you see just how things burn you, why would you do it again? The only reason why we get burnt and suffer so much is because we're stupid. We don't see it. And therefore we just get in the power of our cravings and our ill wills and our guilt and all that stuff, and it creates pain and hurt. If it's really virtue, it has to create peace and freedom and happiness. The same with meditation. If it truly is meditation, if it truly is the power of letting go and pacifying the mind, that too must lead to these things. You're turning away from the worldly things of the five senses. It doesn't mean turning away from the joy of the mind, but turning away from the things of the world. All those things fading away and ceasing. The sense of peace. With it, sort of the happiness. They say Sambodhi here. I'm talking about Sambodhisukha here. The happiness of enlightenment, freedom, peace. That's what I saw in someone like Ajahn Tate. He exuded that. So you can see that was the right path. That's the sort of path I want to do. So you can know you're on the right path by what's happening. And by the peace, the freedom, the stillness, the joy, the balance of one's life. The Buddha actually said, and I chant this when I do the ordination ceremonies, that Sila Paribhavito Samadhi Maha Palo Hoti Mahani Sangso. That when the meditation is empowered by such virtue, then the samadhi is of great power and great fruit. What he's actually saying though, you know, without that restraint of the defilements, without that sort of commitment to do the right thing, the samadhi will be weak. And sometimes, you know, as Westerners, when we look upon samadhi and meditation, you ask, well, you know, should I really watch the breath, or how should I watch the breath, or what should I do when a nimitta arises, and blah, blah, blah. But sometimes we don't look at what's empowering that samadhi, the practice of virtue and restraint. And that's a huge cause for success in samadhi. So it's the restraint of the senses, the abiding by the Patimokkha rules, keeping the precepts. Because you know what we always chant after the Patimokkha, the Tayana Sutta, as the teaching to Tayana, was that Napahai Muni Kame Nekatamu Papajati. That if you don't abandon those five senses and the pleasures which are connected to them, you can never get one pointedness, or the oneness of the mind. There's a great teaching there. And that's why we actually chant that after the Patimokkha, because these are very important teachings. Very important teachings of the Buddha. If we can abandon that sort of sensory desire, you know, about what's happening in the world of the seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and touching, never think that you can purify that world. It's by its very nature it's suffering. By its very nature it just leads to sort of problems and difficulties. That's why, you know, myself trying to build a monastery or trying to build a retreat center or trying to lead a sangha, that's just full of suffering, and I know it's going to be full of suffering because it's in the world of sight, sound, smells, tastes and touches. So it's always a struggle to keep it afloat. And I know that, and I don't really expect it to be any different. So I don't expect to be easy. I was a bit late today, it was just at 7 o'clock, Ajahn Chattamala rang. I told him to ring tomorrow because I just didn't have time to have a proper chat with him. I think one thing I'm going to tell him tomorrow, he said, "You're really stupid if you go to Germany and become an abbot. You should know better having been here for such a long time." But anyhow, you know, if he does, he should know just how tough it is and how much suffering. Simply because, you know, you're in charge more than others of, you know, the five sense world of your fellow monks and kutis and retreat centers and Buddhist societies. But it's always going to be fraught with suffering. That's the nature of that five sense world. So you have to let it go. It's all purpose of meditation, just making the mind peaceful. And from that peace, from that stillness, from that letting go, you get the perspective of the world. In the book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, I gave this simile from the time I was still a layperson. Even before I went to Cambridge, I went to Central America. And that's the time when I sort of climbed this pyramid in the Tikal in the Yucatan Peninsula. And for the first time in days, I could see horizon. Because it was travelling through the jungle. You all know that simile, so I won't elaborate on it. But there's a great sort of simile there, because when you actually climb that pyramid, and it's just above the tree line, when you actually climb a pyramid in the jungle, these are the Mayan civilization pyramids, it was just above the tree line. So it was the first time in days I could see great distances. And that's so true to the simile of what meditation does when it's proper. For the first time you can see sort of huge distances, your mind is clear. And for the first time it can look down upon the world in which you were struggling. You get perspective. You see the pathways, the rivers, where your villages were. That's what happened to me, 3 days of traveling in Guatemala, never seeing the horizon, and just the first time seeing the horizon, that was just mind-blowing. And I could just think what it was like to a young Indian who'd never seen the horizon until, you know, for all their life. And maybe just, you know, the first time they're taking one of these pyramids and they can see infinity in all directions. They can see the layout of their world. This is what we mean by the wisdom. When you step outside and you can see, you see what you've been doing. And sometimes you think, gee, I'm so stupid, I thought I was wise, but I've just been hurting myself and harming others. Just looking at the world in a very stupid way, just like you don't go on the right paths and you're travelling through the jungle, you know, it's just hard slog. When you're high up on that pyramid, looking over the jungle, you can actually see where the best paths are, where the shortest routes are. And that's very close to what it's like when you have proper meditation, you get the wisdom. You can actually get to understand what life is and how it works in the most peaceful, problem-free way of dealing with jungle life. Jungle life is not perfect and never will be perfect. That's the way, the law of the jungle, as they say. But once one goes up there, one sees, ah, yeah, this is what it is. And one doesn't expect from life things which will never be able to give you. That's, you know, my definition of suffering. Suffering is expecting from life what it can never provide you. And if you want too much from life, the things which essentially it can't give you, you suffer. You create that suffering. When you understand the limitations of life, limitations of what you can do and how you behave, then you go through life, not intentionally harming others, but sometimes you will harm someone. That's life. You can't do anything about that. Your sensitivity to the world around you is a wise sensitivity, coming from seeing things truly. So that way you create no harm to yourself or to others, or rather minimal harm. But you never think that it will be harmless. The nature of that jungle is of suffering, is of harm. Like even now you have old age, sickness and death in your own bodies. You have hay fever, you have coughs, you have cancers, you have all sorts of stuff. But this is the nature of having a body. If we can only be at peace with that and accept that. As the Buddha said, the two arrows of suffering, you have the mental arrow and the physical arrow. The physical arrow is our bodies, the ways of the world, seeing people die, seeing animals eat each other. You can't do much about that, that's life. All one can do is take out the mental arrow. The mental arrow is, I don't want this, it shouldn't be this way, why should it be this way? When you stand on top of that pyramid and look over your life, look over the world, having separated yourself from it, distanced yourself from it, to get the perspective, you can come down that pyramid afterwards and be so wise. And the nature of wisdom, again, is the peaceful life, the easy life. A life of minimum suffering. Not no suffering, but minimal suffering. So that's a sign of what wisdom is. I know that sometimes when we talk about wisdom, that people have all these theories, and sometimes, especially when you go overseas, and people ask you about, you know, what jhanas are, what nimittas are, the nature of existence, and what the Four Noble Truths are, dependent origination is, and gee, they haven't got a clue what they're talking about. We still like to ask those high questions. But as the Buddha said, he only taught suffering and the end of suffering. And that's really all you should really teach, is the way of creating peace and happiness in this world. And that way is learning how to leave that world for a short while, to climb that pyramid inside the heart, which we call meditation, and to see things clearly, and to know what wisdom is. To know its characteristics. And that characteristics of wisdom is a peaceful mind, a happy mind, the gentle mind, the mind which knows the middle way, the balance and gentleness. So the Buddha would be able to, just like a mother looks after her children, know the children have to fight. They have to get their sicknesses, because that's part of growing up. They don't get those sicknesses when they're young, they won't have the immunity when they're old. So the wise person sees the big picture. When they see that big picture, they become free. And the sign of freedom is just this beautiful, peaceful life, where sure you have physical problems, but the mental problems are just no more there. Taking out the mental arrow of suffering. So each one of you had enough physical suffering and mental suffering, and sometimes we try to lessen the physical suffering in one way or another. But that's just part of having a body. It's part of living in the world. It's part of living is actually to see that people do stupid things, people to hurt themselves and people to hurt others. You see that even in the forest. You see the kangaroos, for goodness sake, fighting each other. And those of you who feed those kangaroos, you see, notice how greedy they can be, and they can fight other kangaroos. And as they're fighting those other kangaroos, using the magpies are stealing all the best food. And you see, they're just like human beings. But that's the nature of this world. And just you laugh at that, instead of getting upset and angry about it. And you can't do much about it. That's their nature, they have to learn. The same way you just can't do much about the suffering you see around, or the suffering you cause. All you can do is take out the mental error and learn how to be at peace, to minimize the suffering without eliminating it. Because you know the only way that suffering is eliminated, to be completely free, never to be reborn again. That's the only thing you can wish other beings. The highest loving kindness is to wish other beings Nibbana. To wish yourself Nibbana. In the Ratana Sutta, which we would have chanted if there was another talk during this range retreat, he said the Buddha attained Parinibbana, ceased, for the maximum benefits of other beings, Paramang Hitaya. I always like to remember that saying in the suttas. The best possible gift you can give for other beings is to become enlightened. And so sometimes we think that's really what we should be focusing on. If you have any altruism at all, any wish for the happiness and well-being of others, until you are enlightened, no matter what you do, you may think you're helping others, but really you're creating more problems for them. And just going here and going there, you're still creating problems. The only way to stop solving problems in this world is actually go for full enlightenment, to learn how to climb that pyramid in the heart called meditation, and go to the top and go beyond the world to see the big picture by looking over. When you see that bird's eye view, the Aryan eye view, then you can understand how it all works. Then you can come down, and as usually happens when people start to see for the first time, think, gee, how stupid could I be? I thought I was right, I thought I was doing the best thing. I thought that what I did was more clever than other people, but how stupid I was. That's standard for people who become stream winners. How could I miss that all those years? I thought I was wise, I thought I was doing the right thing, I even thought I was being compassionate, but just causing problems for myself and others. So one sees very clearly, one sees the wisdom which creates peace and happiness in this world, not problems. Which doesn't aim for perfection in a world which can't give you perfection. Which never asks more than can be given. And thereby lessens the suffering. So please remember that dukkha, suffering, is asking from this world something it can never give you. Essentially it can't give you. You see that. You've climbed that pyramid and seen from above. Very, very simple teaching on what enlightenment means. And how you can achieve that. And what enlightenment tastes like, what wisdom tastes like, what meditation feels like, and the importance of virtue. Simple teachings of Sila Samadhipanya, the practice of a Buddhist, the triple practice. And once you've achieved that great wisdom, it doesn't matter what happens to your body, you can always be at peace. You try and look after it, but you don't go over the top, nor do you go under the top. You don't starve yourself, you don't get too fat. You don't worry too much about what you eat, but you always eat enough. You practice this beautiful middle way, And the middle way is a person who disappears. Remember, the middle is where you can vanish. If you're too tall or too short, too extreme in either way, you stand out. And that was so brilliant and beautiful about the image with which I started this talk of Ajahn Tate in Thailand. He was in this magnificent palace, but he vanished, he disappeared. So if you went in that room, the room was empty. You had to look twice to see this little old monk sitting in a corner. So your job is to do that. To have a body which is healthy, which is be able to serve, but you vanished. You fit in, and no one knows you're there. So that's a little talk this evening, just on the practice in simplicity, but also in depth. Let's talk this evening.
Bhagavato Sāvaka Sāṅkho Sāṅkhaṁ Namāṁ.